Welcome to Trade Airs, the Trader's Edge podcast. I'm Jim Urio. That's Bob Iacino. We are coming to you with a special show live from Miami at the Money Show's Investor Symposium. Today's going to be an interesting show. We have three guests. We have Jim Bianco, Tracy Shuchart, and Mitch Rochelle. Plus, we're going to have a lot of audience interaction. Thank you guys for joining us.
So you've been right about inflation, and that brings me to the question of, number one, at this point, does the Fed not have any control over what happens to prices, or are they letting it go deliberately? Because we both agree that my job as a strategist is not to say what the Fed should do. It's to say what they're going to do and what the markets are going to do based on that. And because of that, I'm long equities and I'm long gold. But do you think they can do anything, or they're sitting there going, there's nothing we could do about it anyway, so let's just leave it?
Oh, no, they can. You know, the price of money matters, and the price of money can make a difference at the margin. But let me offer you an alternative that I've been thinking about. So I got my tinfoil hat on right now.
Which, by the way, has been the wise move over the last few years.
Right.
Yes.
So let's talk about a realization. When the Fed has a meeting, and Powell talked about this on Good Friday when he gave that speech in San Francisco, that they strive for a unanimous vote. They want every vote to be 12-0 or 11-1. And he thinks that's a virtue. And I said, this is your biggest Achilles heel, is that by striving for a 12-0 vote, you think what you're doing is you're saying, man, this is how confident we are in policy, as opposed to if we had a 7-5 or 8-4 vote. But what you're doing is you're giving a couple of minority opinions enormous power over the Fed. I think that they're stuck. I think what I think that there's two or three doves on the committee headed by Chicago Fed President Austin Goolsbee, who I don't trust, but that's a different question altogether.
No, I agree with you on that.
I think that they want the Fed to cut rates, and I think they want the Fed to cut rates quickly. And if there's any talk about not doing it, they're going to dissent, and that would be a 9-3 vote. And I think that there's a couple of hawks, the Kansas City Fed president, maybe Chris Waller, who are on the other side. So he's almost like, I'm trying to figure out a way to get a 12-0 vote, but whichever way I go, it's going to wind up being 10-2 or 9-3, and the Fed can't be like the Supreme Court. They can't be like the Bank of England, or they can't be like the Bank of Japan. They have 9 voters. They'll have a 5-4 vote. It's just like the Supreme Court. We have a 5-4 vote. That's the policy. But no, they want this desire to be 11-1 or 12-0. So that gives one or two people that are willing to say, I'm going to dissent. You're still going to get a 10-2 vote. You're still going to get what you want, but they give them enormous power because they want everybody to agree with them. He also goes on to say that the way that he accomplishes that is before every FOMC meeting, like the week before, there's 19 members, 12 of them vote. He meets with all 19, or 18, he's the 19th. He meets with the other 18 members, and he has a one-on-one meeting about policy. And I like to say, this is where you get to go into the chairman's office, and he'll put on a serious face, and you tell him what he's doing wrong, and he'll pretend like he's listening to you, but then you're going to walk out of the room and do what he tells you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. Okay, so a couple more minutes with you, because there's something, when you talked about in the other thing, you said bonds are giving you a buffer now, so it's not a bad place to be. Again, this is one of the rare times I disagree with Jim Bianco, and pretty much every time I've been wrong, I think. I believe that appetite for long-end bonds is waning. The supply is growing. Part of your contention is that the Fed is going to step back in and start sponsoring auctions? Or is it possible that prices just collapse in long end because of the wait?
No, I when I said that bonds are you know, it's the coupon is what I was talking about. Look, I still am thinking that, I've been on this all year, that by the end of the year, we will see the 10-year trade to 5 to 5.5. Now we're 450 now. We started the year at 380 when I started talking about that. Well, between 450, when yields were to go from 450 to 5 to 5.5 this year, you're going to get, at least for the next 8 months of the year, you're still going to get 3 or 4% coupon on top of whatever price loss you have. So your total return is not going to be horrible. This is what I was trying to make the difference is, 2022, 2021, when interest rates were zero, you were buying bonds, you were buying a dirty bond, is what you were buying. You were just waiting for them to blow up, and they were offering you no cushion in terms of a coupon. And they did. And that's why you had that horrible return. But I've heard so many people say bonds have been so terrible over the last 2 years. You're right. But now that they have a yield, they're not in the same poor risk position that they were 2 years ago. So I agree with you. I think yields are going to go up. I've been in the, I think inflation is bottomed in the 3 to 4% camp, not 8-10 Zimbabwe, but 3 to 4%. And that means that we're probably going to see interest rates continue to trend higher towards 5 to 5.5. The last thought I'd give you on this is I like to say that's my forecast. And I have the Bloomberg Professional Service on my desk. And the reason I say that is because I got the little, you know, scrolling news screen. And that's my forecast until I see some red headline come across my Bloomberg and I go, oh shit, now it just changed.
Well, no, so it's supposed to just change.
It hasn't happened yet. Yeah. It hasn't happened yet. But if it does, I'll change my forecast.
All right. So the last thing I want to ask you, and from a perspective of inflation, because to me, I think we're in a reflationary regime where assets are going to go up and inflation is going to continue to go up. And because of that, I'm long stocks. Do you see any sort of, again, canary in the coal mine?
We need to gotta use something else there too, although it's very
something that might kick my view in the nards.
A parakeet in the garage.
A parakeet in the garage.
Do they die too when the car
is
on? Yeah, okay,
do you see anything in the in sort of that forecast that's gonna hurt the economy before the Fed does?
So let me answer the question this way. There was a Fed economist named Rudy Dornbusch, and he had a famous line that he said, economic expansions do not die of old age, they're murdered. And what he meant by that was the natural state of a capitalist economy is to expand. Because in a capitalist economy, you're supposed to constantly be taking money away from bad ideas and giving money to good ideas, and you keep expanding. Something happens that causes a recession. They don't die of old age, and the two biggest culprits, not the only ones, but the two biggest culprits that cause recessions are spike in oil prices or suffocatingly high interest rates. Well, we were just talking about this an hour ago. And Charles mentioned it on the stage in the previous session. If you look at the headlines in the last 2 or 3 hours about that Iran is supposedly going to start bombing Israel. And 2 days ago, the story was if they start or drone attacking them or missile attacking them or something like that. And 2 days ago, there was a story that if they did that, they were told that the United States would intervene. We could see
this by Monday. Yeah.
If something like that was to come about, higher interest rates breaks an economy. Just two other real quick things. It doesn't have to be those two things that would, you know, be your canary in a coal mine. Look, you know, 9/11, geopolitical, a COVID, you know, broke the economy. Those broke the economies as well too. The invasion of Kuwait by Iraq in 1991 broke the economy. So I would say that the natural state of the economy is to expand, that there is those types of things that can break it. High interest rates is another one that's brought about by inflation, but I don't think 5% is that break point. I think it's much higher. Jamie Dimon came out a couple of days ago and said 8%. He thinks that interest rates could go to 8.
Jeez.
That might be a good place to start looking for it to be at a suffocating level. But he also prefaced that that's over many years. It's not like immediate or something like that.
So we have a question, but it's nice that he mentioned oil prices because we have Tracy coming on next, which is the perfect person to talk about oil.
Hey, Jim. So it's only yesterday that we talked about the suffering that regional banks are going through, that 70% of commercial real estate loans are provided by those banks. Do you believe that having those high interest rates will not break regional banks?
The regional bank problem, let me set the table on this question real quick. In most developed countries in the world, you have like 5 banks. And in the United States, we have like 4,000. And a lot of people think that that's a weakness, that we have so many banks. I actually think it's a strength, and I'll tell you why. Because in most countries, A bank has two functions, right? It's a money warehouse. It's a place you park your money. Well, if that's all you want is instead of putting it in a box under your bed, you just want a place to put your money, we only need 5 large banks. But a bank is also somebody that intermediates credit. It hands out credit. And we're better off by having lots of banks that specialize in certain things and are in certain regions, and that it puts the banker closer to that business and helps that business in terms of getting credit. So I like that system that we have the way it is right now. Now that I've said that, the problem that regional banks are facing is, as you mentioned, 70% of commercial real estate loans come from a regional or small bank. So you know, this building was probably financed by a regional bank out of Florida. It was not probably, I'll probably be wrong on this, but I'm guessing it was not financed by Chase or Citi or any of those other ones. That's the way that the regional banking system works. The biggest problem that regional banks are having is they financed office towers for the last 20 years. No one's going back to the office. And now they have to figure out, they've got mortgages on all these office towers. These office towers are worth a fraction of what they used to think they're worth, and they don't want the owner of the office tower, you know, to use the term, mailing the keys back to them. I don't need it. I want you to keep running it. I just want you to pay me. That's really what I want. Lowering interest rates does not get people back into the office. And that's what they need. They need to repurpose offices to make them useful again. That is not fixed with interest rates. It might be fixed with some regulations. It might be fixed with some other things. So I don't think that the regional banking problem is as much an interest rate problem as it is that they've got a bunch of bad real estate. And on top of that, they've also got this idea that they have to now compete with money markets on deposit rates. You know, you put your money in the bank and you look at a money market fund of 5.3%. Well, this was 20 years ago. It was very difficult to move your money from the bank to a money market fund. Today, you could do it on this thing in about 3 minutes. So they have to basically compete with mobile banking apps, and that pushes up the deposit rates that they have to offer and lowers their NIMs. Would cutting interest rates help there? Yeah, at the margin it would, but they still have to compete with it. You know, they're not going to cut rates to 1%. But if they cut it a couple times, it really wouldn't help them that much.
Will the number of banks failing be greater than 200 in the next year?
In the next what?
Year.
That's a good question, only because you get every day, every week, you get banks that fail. But a lot of them are tiny banks.
No, I mean like mid-sized banks, like banks that we care about.
Banks we care about? No, I don't think it will be. It won't be nearly that high, only because the idea of the FDIC never really wants them to get to that point. They kind of they shotgun marriage them with somebody else.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's why we have 4,000 out of 15,000, which we had 20 years ago.
Right, 15,000 banks. Yeah. That was clearly too many.
Yeah.
4,000 banks still might be too many, but, you know, I don't think the answer is 12.
Janet Yellen does.
You run a restaurant in suburban Chicago, you would prefer to deal with a regional bank
that
knows your business, as opposed to calling somebody downtown Chicago at a Chase.
No doubt about it.
So she's got a quick follow-up, then I want to go over here.
That was a great question, by the way. Then we got to get to Tracy.
Why isn't the 10-year above just the short-term yield curve? I can't figure it out unless Janet Yellen is manipulating this thing in cahoots with Powell.
Well, she's been trying to manipulate it by cutting back on the amount of notes and bonds that they've issued in issuing more bills. And that can work for a while, and it did in November and December. But if you have $1 trillion of debt coming every 100 days, you got one shot at doing it, and you did it already. You know, so it can't really work. Here's the issue with the inverted yield curve. As I come to places like here about the Money Show and other like places, and I say interest rates are going to go up, it gets a receptive audience. You understand that interest rates might be heading higher, that the inflation is coming. I go to London or New York and I talk to, you know, big institutional managers. No, there's going to be a bond rally. And interest rates are going to go down. And I am long and I am ready for that interest rate rally. They're not positioned for higher interest rates. They're not believing that they're going to come. And I think that that's changing right now, because so far this year, the 10-year yield is up 70 basis points or 0.7% this year. Half that move came in the last 2 weeks. So I think we're probably if we're not in the repricing, that those big institutional managers are starting to think, oh, I guess that this idea that we're going to have a slowdown or a soft landing and a moderation of inflation to 2%, and I want to be long interest rates, they're giving up on it right now. And if they do, I think that the inverted yield curve is going to uninvert exactly what you said. In bond market parlance, it's called a bear steepener. Bear meaning rates go up, and steepener means that short rates go up, long rates go up faster than short rates, and it uninverts the curve. That is a, from a Wall Street perspective, the bear steepener to an uninversion is a painful thing for Wall Street. That's why when I said that the 10-year yield, I thought, would go to 5 to 5.5 this year. What I also didn't mention then, I'll mention now, is I don't think the Fed's going to cut rates. We're already at 5.25 to 5.5 in the funds rate, so that forecast is implying a zero yield curve, and that we might wind up seeing a zero yield curve coming here in the next several months.
So we've got a quick follow-up here, and then we literally dragged Bianco in here.
He's got to go.
Go ahead.
Do you believe there is a chance that lowering interest rates would alleviate the pain we have in oil supply chain constraints?
Would it
help production? Would it help credit?
No, I don't.
Growth?
You know, Tracy would be a better one to answer.
Yeah, Tracy would be a better one for
that. Whether or not lowering interest rates would help supply, but what lowering interest rates would do is it could stimulate demand. And I'll make one comment about lowering interest rates. A lot of people ask me this question, of course the Fed's going to cut interest rates because Powell doesn't want Trump. He hates Trump from all the mean tweets from the last time and stuff. And so he's going to cut rates because he wants Biden to be reelected. And I said, you know, cutting rates is not like saying, I want candy to fall from the sky and it's only good. If you cut rates and make the cost of money cheaper, you're stimulating the economy. If you do that, when people are credibly worried about inflation, the bond market blows up. Because then bond investors say, there's inflation, you're going to stimulate, you're going to make more inflation, I don't want to own your 10-year, and the price of the 10-year plunges and the interest rates go up. So if you cut rates thinking, I want Biden to win, if you assume that that's what Powell wants, and people are worried about inflation, you've now made it worse. So that's why it's not, you know, like I said, it's not just cut rates, candy falls from the sky, and everybody's happy. You cut rates in the wrong environment, and you wind up making it worse. So as far as your question about crude oil, I don't know about how it would help on the supply side. Maybe in the very long term, if there was lower cost of money, but that's over many years. You know, you can buy more equipment, increase production. But in the short term, if you cut rates and you stimulate the economy, then all you're going to do is get people to buy more gasoline. And then you're just going to push the price of gasoline higher is what you wind up doing. And that's what you don't want. And then the price of gasoline goes up and bond investors go even more inflation and they sell bonds even harder. Right. And you wind up making it worse from there.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Let's give Jim a hand if that's okay. Thank you, Jim. Thanks. That was so fun. We'll see you soon.
Tracy, do you have any opinion on that question about the production,
that's what I
wanted to inflation? Thanks, Jim.
Cutting rates would not stimulate supply. Again, I agree with Jim. Over the long term, it can, just because you can get financing for bigger projects and equipment and so on and so forth. But the problem really within the oil market right now goes a lot deeper than that. First, you have, you know, we have problems in the shale industry right now with declining DUCs, which are drilled but uncompleted wells. We have lower rig counts. We have tier one acreage is getting very small. But what we are seeing is producers don't, you know, they'll invest in the technology to get as much as they possibly can out of existing wells. They don't want to drill new wells, and investors don't want to see them drill new wells and go crazy in debt and drill baby drill and oil prices collapse and these companies are in debt. So they've been very, very careful on kind of bringing down their debt, reining in some of that production, even though, you know, it's still 2023 was an all-time high, but I would argue that that's probably done and gone, and we're going to see decline from here on out. And we also see larger companies, we see a lot of M&As in this sector right now. And what we're seeing is the big guys are buying out the small guys because they're buying capacity instead of building out capacity. And that's how they're expanding their business right now. And I don't think lower interest rates would change that business model for now.
So Tracy, do you think there's any truth to the idea that China specifically, but globally, that EV demand is actually going to start hitting fossil fuel demand or no?
No.
That was quick.
That was awful quick. Just flat out no.
Just no. You know, I think what we are seeing is I think reality is starting to set in, and we're looking at EV demand. And yes, China is, you know, out of the top 20 producers, China's 16 of those. And yes, that market is growing within China and it is growing within Europe, but we're definitely not seeing that in South America. We're definitely not seeing that here in North America. So I think that any thoughts that, you know, by 2030 or 2035 that we're going to be 50% EVs is completely misguided and misplaced hopes, particularly for the United States, when we're looking at, you know, where EV market's only, you know, 5 to 7% of the global market.
This thing in the Middle East, it has the potential to blow up and be catastrophic, right? And to Jim's point, that could be the last shoe to drop to break up whatever kind of nascent expansion we currently have, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one thing to behold. What we kind of didn't touch upon is OPEC. We still know that, you know, OPEC has voluntary cuts of over 1 million barrels a day, along with their cuts that the whole group is doing. And so the question remains, does Saudi Arabia decide we're going to take our voluntary cuts off, and because they're shouldering most of the burden of that? And start producing another 1 million barrels a day. My counter argument to that would be, yes, I think it's possible, but not probable, at least for another quarter or so, depending on, you know, where oil prices are. But there's really no incentive for them to do. First of all, their capacity is much less than what they say. So I think they want to keep that. Their excess capacity, they want to keep that for as long as they possibly can because they make a lot of money on it. And they also have huge aggressive projects right now to kind of build out Saudi Arabia as a tourist nation, and other projects like NEOM, and they have big bills to pay right now. And they're very happy with, you know, oil sitting at $80, $90 a barrel. And they know very well what happens when they flood the market, which was exactly what happened in March of 2020 when Russia and Saudi Arabia got in an argument and they turned on the taps and we went negative oil prices in April of 2020.
I'm going to pivot for 1 second and talk to Mitch.
I filled up my pool at home with oil.
Just, yeah. same here.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean,
$5 they paid me to take it, so.
I think that's the trend. Ice baths and filling up your pool with oil.
Mitch is the guy who doesn't need a microphone.
Right, exactly. But no, I want to go to Mitch, because if you guys have follow us, you know that we've been asset bulls, you know, up to our eyeballs for the last year and a half, oil being one of those. Real estate we don't talk about as much. I personally think real estate is an excellent place to be outside of commercial real estate. Mitch, do you concur? What are you seeing?
If you look at wealth accumulation throughout history, there's only two ways that wealth historically have been accumulated. One is precious metals. I'm like literally going back to biblical times. And the other is real estate. The precious metals basket, going back to biblical times, has evolved. So anything that's a trading asset, anything with a CUSIP number, anything you can settle a trade with, currencies, those are in that precious metals basket. The property basket hasn't changed at all. Okay, it's still investing in real estate. But there are two truths. One, and we're seeing it today, in times of uncertainty, what do people do in the trading asset basket? They start rotating back to the safest play. What are they doing? They're buying gold.
Cool.
Okay? We're seeing it literally happen right now. The other thing that's a truth is in times of uncertainty, people rotate out of the trading asset basket and start putting wealth into real estate. Yeah. The blocking factor there is interest rates. So if you are buying real estate because you like positive leverage and you want to use other people's money, you're not going to be one to rotate. But those who want real estate because it's permanent, okay, it's a physical permanent asset, they put cash into real estate. And I'll give you a case study example of that. What happens when there's global instability? People from other sovereign nations buy condos in Manhattan. Okay. Why? Because they know over time real estate values in Manhattan really sort of never fall, so they buy condos in Manhattan. The Chinese were doing it. What happened when the British sort of mandate over Hong Kong was evaporating? What did the Hong Kong Chinese buy? Vancouver. They literally bought Vancouver. Okay. These are one or two random examples of what happened. So right now we're in a period of global instability. So people are rotating to gold. They're also sort of stealthily rotating to real estate. But the headlines don't reflect that. The headlines reflect 4,000 regional banks, complete shit show, and empty office buildings, and there's going to be an apocalypse. But I said to Bobby out in the hallway, and I said, for those of you who heard me yesterday, every one of those people saying that are the same people that said, wow, you can order packages and they show up at your door. You don't have to shop. Retail is dead. Okay. Who went to a supermarket in the last 2 weeks? Is it still there? Yes. Is it in a shopping center? Yes. Are there other stores in a shopping center? Yes. Who went to a mall? Is every storefront in the mall vacant? No. Okay. Now, are there retail centers that should have never been built in the first place because they were in anticipation of a path of growth that never happened? Absolutely. Are there office buildings that are stupid that probably should have never been built because the microeconomy in that city was never going to grow that quickly? Absolutely. However, we still need office buildings. We're always going to need office buildings. At some point, people are going to go back to the office. At some point, we won't have 8.8 million job openings in America. And the balance of power between employees and employers is going to shift, and people are going to start going back to the office. One of my kids went for a job interview yesterday, and he asked the intelligent question, what's your policy? And they said, it's a hard Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday in the office. That is the most idiotic thing I've ever heard. Why? Because if you tell everybody they have to go to the office Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, what do you do on Mondays and Fridays? And are you paying rent on Mondays and Fridays? Mm-hmm. What every company in America needs to do is, if you want your people to be flexible and be in the office 3 days, that's fine. But it's a rotating 3-day schedule.
Of course.
So you can actually intelligently use that space. Companies just haven't figured it out yet, because they're more concerned with diversity, equity, and inclusion policies and what bathroom people get to use, that they're petrified to tell an employee, get your ass back into a seat. Okay? This too shall pass, and office buildings are not dead. So let me go to the regional bank question, okay? Love him, but the gentleman sitting in this seat before is wrong. It's not the debt on this building is held by, I guarantee it, a CMBS trust, Commercial Mortgage Backed Securities Trust. Guarantee it, okay? Because that's how real estate for cash flowing properties has been financed, through the CMBS markets, through life insurance companies. Regional banks fund real estate loans on real estate in their backyard. So it's a less than 100,000 square foot little tilt up office building in the backyard of that bank. That building is probably way more occupied than the Wells Fargo building across the street. Now, we are in Florida, so people got their asses back to the office about 2 years ago. But that building in Midtown Manhattan, that building in the Loop in Chicago, probably not fully occupied, because those employers haven't sort of realized that they don't have to have a mask policy still. But the reality is, the regional banks aren't as in bad shape as they are. The elephant in the room is commercial mortgage-backed securities and how messed up they really are, because they have maturities on loans that couldn't possibly refinance.
Well, what's the difference then? If the whole thing is a shit show and it's going to crack, who cares if it's actually the regional bank? I'll just stop saying regional banks. I'll start saying the CMBS market.
Why don't we just say the commercial mortgage market? Okay.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Because I have a case study. What happened the last time we had an issue in CMBS? Okay. The global financial crisis. They did the extend and pretend. They just kept extending those loans, kicking the can down the road. If the property generates $10 million in cash flow, if the debt service on that property is $11 million, guess what they're going to do? They're going to lower the debt service to $10 million
to make it work.
Suck all it out. They have a mechanism in the documents to lockbox cash receipts, okay? They're going to do it, okay? Who's going to get caught holding the bag in those loans? Probably private equity funds, probably hedge funds that own the, you know, the subordinate tranches and CMBS. But it's not going to happen tomorrow, and it's not going to take down the financial system. I truly believe that this is a way bigger issue in because of the politics of it, because they want a finger to point at somebody for this. But I don't think it's the thing that's going to crack.
Yeah. You're never coming back on the show, because I hate when people effectively convince me that I'm wrong about something. I don't like that at all. That was an excellent argument.
I can come back on your show and I'll,
no, it's never
I'll curse more on the air. I just don't want
to. And there's absolutely no cursing on the show at all.
Because I don't think the problem is as bad as people. So let's just talk about an office situation. The average office lease of a credit-worthy tenant is probably 10 years, okay? If they entered into the lease in 2019, they're gonna be paying rent until 2029. If I did that math in my head, I think I'm right, okay? By 2029, most of this will have flushed out, okay? It's those leases that were in the middle and are rolling over. I have clients that are big landlords that I do strategy consulting for, and they were way more freaked out about the apartment market in the midst of COVID, when everybody was running back to their parents' house and not renewing leases, than they are their commercial office exposure. So I don't think you have to really look at lease maturities and then do what I do, which is look at what's happening with those leases are actually getting renewed. The fact of the matter is, what was $120 rent in Midtown Manhattan may have gotten repriced to $40, okay? But what no one's talking about is who's paying the additional $40. Everybody see the movie Moneyball?
Yep.
Great
yeah.
Scene in Moneyball when David Justice is hitting balls and Billy Bean comes in there. And Billy Bean drops the bomb on David Justice that the Yankees were actually paying the Oakland A's to get David Justice off of their payroll. That's what's going on in commercial real estate. Some tenant that is subleasing to somebody else because they don't need the space is still on the hook for a part of that rent. And they lowered their exposure from $80 per square foot to $40 per square foot, and they're eating the $40 a square foot. That's too
spread out.
Pass.
Yeah. Yep.
I should have put our disclaimer up on the screen, but I didn't. Jimmy and I have a disclaimer that is not Tradier's disclaimer, it's not their disclaimer, but it basically says, if you take anything any of us say and do a trade, that's on you, not us. Number two, we think our data is pretty solid, but we could be wrong about something. And number three, we cuss a lot because that's how people talk. So if anyone's offended, let us know. We'll try and curb it, but we'll probably fail at that.
It's been a failure so far.
Yeah, I want to ask Tracy something, and then I know we got a question back there. He's been holding his hand up for a while.
But oh, I didn't see. I'm sorry. Yeah,
that's okay. As I trade energy more than anything, I know that's your focus, Tracy, and I wanted to ask you if you think there's a level in crude oil specifically, or RBOB, or whatever you want to comment on, that cracks the asset market a little bit. Is an area with crude oil that the asset market starts saying, we don't give a shit, sorry, we don't give a darn what the Fed is doing or what anything else is, oil's too high?
Yeah, I definitely think there's an, I think we're going to, if we have sustained oil prices, I mean sustained, not a spike, over $100, you're going to start seeing cracks, particularly in emerging markets, and that will lead to a contagion. And I know people are talking about $200 oil, $300 oil, but I think the market cracks before those prices.
If I believe that there's this much of a chance for the de-dollarization thing to gather steam around the globe, I don't believe it's going to happen. But I believe there's enough people who think it's going to happen who start piling into these other assets. And that's what we're here for. We're trying to figure out what's going up and what's going down. So me saying, like arguing with Brent Johnson, I don't believe that the dollar is going to go to hell. I think the dollar is going to hell, but not if you want to buy yen, but that's a totally different discussion. But all we're trying to do is predict what other people do. But Tracy, as far as oil goes, like yesterday I said I bought one of the Big integrateds. Where do you think is the best place? What I think you're saying is that oil's probably going higher. That's where the path of least resistance is. How do you play it? I hate to use the word play. Such a CNBC word. They always wanted that kind of talk, like it was a sports show.
No, I think producers are great. The oil majors are going to do well. I still think we're going to see more mergers and acquisitions. So I'd be careful of some of these smaller companies unless... it's a kind of a short-term trade, and you think they're going to get bought out, that raises their stock price. That's fantastic, but that's not kind of a longer-term investment. And I also think that refiners are doing very well, too. The little overextended right now, but I think, if you get a pullback in the miners or in the refiners, those are going to do very well because crack spreads have remained elevated because we have not enough refining capacity. We still have demand growing, and we don't have enough supply coming on the market. So that's where, I think those are two good places to kind of start.
Okay. Well, thank you guys so much. This has been a ton of fun. And this is TradeAir's Trader's Edge podcast. I'm Jim Uriel, Bob Iacino, Tracy Shuchart, Mitch Rochelle, that was Jim Bianco left. But thank you to you guys who are here and to you guys who are watching. And you'll remember what we're trying to do here. We are both kind of castaways from mainstream media because they kind of told you what your opinion was supposed to be. And we're trying to create a forum that doesn't do that. And we thank you guys for being part of it. Thank you.
All opinions expressed by TradeAir Hub contributors are solely the contributors' opinions and do not reflect the opinions of TradeAir nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Hub contributors as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or to follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of their opinion. The contributors' opinions are based on their own personal research, but neither TradeAir nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrants its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. Any trades or positions discussed or referred to by contributors may or may not be actual live trades or positions. Such information is not intended to be financial or investment advice. TradeAir Inc. is the parent company of TradeAir Brokerage Inc. TradeAir Brokerage Inc. and TradeAir Inc. are separate entities with their own products and services. Securities products and services are offered through TradeAir Brokerage Inc. TradeAir Brokerage Inc. is an independent subsidiary of TradeAir Inc., all rights reserved, member FINRA.